Microphone is on. Oh my God, this is bright. Wow, this is too bright for the morning. All right, so welcome everyone. I can't see how many people we are here now. You guys are all spread all over the place. It'd be better if everybody was here, but anyways. So first of all, thank you for waking up so early to come for an 8 a.m. session. Greatly appreciate it. Definitely, it's a great topic and we're gonna have a lot of fun. Well, hopefully you'll find it fun. And it's also, it's not just a fun topic. I know it sounds like it's just like for playing with toys and everything, and it's not really much of a use for this. But trust me, there's a whole industry behind this. And one of the main purposes and why I'm gonna talk about the world of makers today, or rather the Internet of Things, is basically to explain how there's an opportunity for developers. It's kind of like back in 2002 when I started telling people, hey folks, the world is going mobile. Building apps that run at work or at home is not enough. We're gonna have to cover people in between when they're not in front of a computer. And everybody was like, yeah, sure, kind of. You know, it's gonna come later, maybe. And yeah, sure enough, nobody complains about mobility today. Everybody knows that it's about mobile. So it's kind of like the same thing today. I'm here to tell you about the Internet of Things and how there's a great opportunity out there. And a lot of you might think like, yeah, sure, maybe it's, maybe later. But then you can ask yourself, do you want to be an early adopter and a pioneer? Or do you want to enter many, many years from now when the market is crowded and saturated and most of the great opportunities are gone? It's like trying to make money from mobile today. I'm not saying that you shouldn't do mobile development, but mobile development has become one of those things that all companies kind of have to do. It's not a big money-making scheme anymore. Yeah, sure, there's always going to be like a unicorn or two popping left and right, where there will be more opportunities and they'll disrupt an industry or something, but it's hard. You're also competing against like giants or people that are very well funded, so it's much harder. So here I am talking about the Internet of Things today. So my name is Nick Landry. I'm a technical evangelist at Microsoft. I'm based in New York. And all the stuff that I talk about today, all the slides are already in the repository. I think I added maybe like one slide since the time that I submitted those slides, and I will make sure that it's updated. Everything else is pretty much still the same. All my code, everything is on GitHub as well, so github.com/ActiveNick. And if you're on Twitter, you can find me at ActiveNick and might as well hit the follow button while you're at it. So today, what are we gonna talk about? First of all, I can't really do an entire session about the purpose of the Internet of Things. There's a lot of theory, and I wanna get to the fun stuff as fast as possible. But at the same time, it's kind of important that I position why should we care about the Internet of Things? Because otherwise you'll think all I did was basically show you how to blink a few things with a Raspberry Pi, and you're still not gonna understand why is this important, you know, for me as a developer. I will also do a quick recap on the Universal Windows platform. Windows 10 is a year old now. The Universal Windows platform is a year old, but technically it's more than just a few years old, because the Universal Windows platform takes its root in WinRT, which is the runtime that we had in Windows 8 before. So it's nothing completely new. It's the new runtime of Windows. And it's important that you understand the role of UWP, because this is going to be the model that we use to build applications for Windows 10 IoT Core. I will talk about, I will basically, of course, introduce Windows 10 IoT Core. I guess that should have been part of the agenda. And we'll talk quickly about electronics from the perspective of a software engineer. So if you're not someone who grew up disassembling toasters and VCRs, don't worry, this is not required. I was not one of those people either. For me, actually, the world of electronics is something that I've only entered a few years ago. And I'm nowhere near an expert. I mean, if you're an electrical engineer, I know some people are, you probably know a lot more than I do about all this stuff. We'll also look quickly about some of the new features that have been added to Windows 10 IoT Core with the Windows 10 Anniversary Update. So as you know, Windows 10 Anniversary Update is shipping now, and that means that there are new features on the phone, there's new features on the desktop, there's new features on Xbox, on the HoloLens, and also on Windows 10 IoT Core for these devices. I do have some live demos here. I was having a few connectivity issues this morning, so hopefully we'll be able to get through that. Otherwise, I have a camera here that you'll be able to see the hardware, but anyway, otherwise you'll see live debugging. That's gonna be pretty much like the experience. We'll see. And then The other thing that's important for me is that since this is a session where I can only scratch the surface, I want to make sure that I tell you where to go from here. So my deck has a lot of information on where to go from here, what can you build, what should you learn, and basically what are your next steps as makers and IoT developers. So let's start with a very quick recap of the world of IoT, so the Internet of Things, which is pretty much like, why should you care about all this stuff? If you look at the world of IoT, the Internet of Things, it's, first of all, it's nothing new. Let's not think that IoT is something that just emerged a few years ago. It's been around for a long time. In fact, at Microsoft, we've been in this world for over 20 years because we have had products like Windows Embedded and Windows CE that have basically been running on embedded systems, electronics, and industrial settings, controlling robots and conveyor belts and industrial manufacturing and things like that. I mean, I don't know the exact statistic, but I think something like 60 to 70% of all ATMs on the planet are running Windows. You just don't see it. You know, you're not going to see the start menu, and you can't alt-tab into solitaire when you're trying to get 20 bucks. But it is still Windows that's running under the hood. A lot of them are running Linux as well, but still the majority are still running Windows. And if we look at the world of IoT, which is the Internet of Things, which means essentially what it means is connecting things together. We've been focusing until now on connecting people first with their computers, then with their phones. And now we're actually connecting the rest of the things so that we can gather data, we can gather intelligence from the things around us, and eventually even control the things around us. So in 2010, the world of IoT was pretty much centered around like some automobiles that gave you access to some features you could connect to, a few novelty refrigerators that you could see at CES, you know, that would help you track the stuff that's in them, alarm clocks that can connect to Bluetooth or Wi-Fi, a computer, of course, and all the other stuff like printers, media players, even microwaves could, for example, give you an alarm. Some home automation stuff, cell phones, of course, are part of that. Vending machines have been using this for a long time so that they would know when certain items run out ahead of time and then send a notification back to the head office so that they can resupply the machine. Security systems are kind of a given as well. Because when it comes to security systems, you don't want to just have like a camera with someone sitting in front of it. It's much better if you can have like motion detectors, raise alarms, send notifications. So that's pretty much been, and smart TVs, of course. So that's pretty much been kind of like the picture of IoT. But now, things got a lot more complicated. There's so much stuff. Now you've got like fitness trackers and health monitoring, so we can keep track of all sorts of things about us using like either smartwatches or fitness trackers and Microsoft Band and things like that. You got beacons. You've got even indoor navigation now, which is kind of like GPS, but like for inside of a mall, for example. You've got even devices, for example, to monitor the health of a child to make sure that, for example, you know if they're still breathing at night because of, you know, sudden infant death syndrome. It could be elderly people in their room or in a facility for elderly care or even in a hospital. And of course, hospitals have been using these things for a long time, but now more and more people can use them. So I can't go through all of this. I mean, this is way too much. The bottom line is you can connect everything, and there's still like a giant majority of devices out there that can be connected that are not connected. And then after that, it's going to be about gathering data. But processing this data is going to be impossible. You can't just like put it in a dashboard and hope that someone can gather information from it. They'll basically have to have rules and machine learning, for example, to be able to really gather some intelligence from this and then act on it afterwards. So if we look at the amount of data that has been created versus the number of devices that exist, if we look at today, PCs and phones pretty much form the majority of our devices, tablets to an extent, but already by 2016, the Internet of Things has completely dwarfed the number of all other devices that we've been using. And it just keeps on growing. So you can see like an explosion of devices. And the average statistics say that there are on average about 200 connectable devices per person in the world. 200. So we're way beyond like your laptop and your smartphone and your TV, you know? And if we look at the amount of data that has been created so far, we are, so this is a statistic that dates from about 2014. We were about at 4.4 zettabytes of information that had been created in the history of mankind, you know? Well, I mean, it's more like during that year. And then after that, the idea is that by 2016 now, we're already at 10 zettabytes. So we're basically creating in 2 years more data than has been created in the history of mankind coming before. It's huge. And of course, there's a lot of data that it's not going to be like as meaningful as the works of Shakespeare, for example. But it's still going to be information about the things that are around us. So how do you process this data? Well, you're going to need a lot of help for this. So there's Moore's Law that keeps plowing ahead, you know, giving us cheaper processors with more power at low power, more CPU power at low battery power. And then you have Metcalfe's Law, which is basically on connectivity, the ability to connect more and more devices and to create more connections the more devices you add. And then there's Koumé's Law, which is actually more interesting because it shows the computations we can get per kilowatt hour, showing that chips are getting more and more efficient, and every year we can get more CPU power for the same amount of energy that we have. So IoT is basically the next revolution because, first of all, the hardware just keeps getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. It's funny, you know how Facebook gives you these like memories, like, oh, 3 years ago you did this. It keeps reminding you about all the stuff you posted before. And I just saw yesterday on Facebook a post that I had put on in 2009 when I was commenting on all my upgrades to Windows 7, where basically I was upgrading all my devices and I had just upgraded my netbook, which was a $400 device, a tiny little netbook. And I was so amazed. I was like, wow, my little netbook is so amazing that Windows 7 can run on a $400 device with only 1 gigabyte of RAM. And now today I have basically an HP Stream tablet that's like $75. That's more powerful than this. And I can run Windows 10 on it. So it just shows how the hardware is just getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. I bought tablets for my kids, like Amazon Kindle tablets, $50 each. You know, why buy an iPad when you can give a kid a $50 tablet? If they break it, then who cares? So yeah, the hardware just keeps getting cheaper. The connectivity is getting more and more pervasive because more and more things can be connected. The development is also getting easier because it used to be very hard to actually do development with electronics, but then the Arduino came along, really revolutionized the world of electronics and how easy it is to program it. And then finally, we'll see new innovative scenarios. And just like, for example, remember in 2007, 2008, when the iPhone came out and the App Store opened up, I mean, back then, the mobility scenarios that we thought about were still very conventional. It took many years for the modern world of mobility to really hit its stride, you know, for the Ubers and the Airbnbs of the world to really come in and disrupt entire industries. So it's pretty much it's going to be the same thing with IoT, where there's going to be a lot of bread and butter stuff that people will be doing, given that they will use home automation and maybe remote security and things like that. But it's going to go well beyond that once people start finding these more innovative scenarios. What are the scenarios? I don't know. You tell me. I mean, as long as you jump into this field, you will probably discover something at some point that everybody will go, wow. But of course, there's a lot of considerations as well. Security is the first one. We've already heard about how people have been able now to remotely hack into a car. So if you hack into a moving car, well, that can have like very serious ramifications. And if you want to take over a building, you don't need to come in with like a team of people with guns and explosives. You can just hack into the building to hack into the security system and maybe fire up the fire alarm and maybe lock down the elevators or something. So, of course, in terms of a diehard movie, it's not going to be as exciting, but definitely, that was a joke, by the way. No, nobody's seen Die Hard when they take over the building at Christmas. Never mind. So, I know it's only 8 a.m., but so we'll go easy on the jokes. But the bottom line is security is going to be a big consideration. So, at Microsoft, as I said, we've been in this field for about 20 years now, and we have two main areas of focus. One is more on the client side with Windows, where we have multiple IoT editions of Windows that will basically give you access to the same platform on all devices, making it easy as a developer. And then you've got on the server, you've got Azure. Because of course, with all of this data, one of the reasons why IoT is also exploding now is because there's so much data out there that's being generated that until the advent of the cloud, there was just no way to capture all this data. Any data center that you can stand up on your own would just get completely flooded with data and overloaded with the sheer amount of information that can be generated and processed by all these sensors. So the cloud, as we all know, the benefits is like you scale as you go, you pay as you go, it's easy to provision, it's self-service, it can go really high. But then beyond that, it's not just about storing the data. Because for example, if you have 10,000 devices out there that are sending sensor data every second, or even every 5 seconds, can you imagine the amount of data that's being sent? Are you gonna store all of this? No, you're not. It doesn't make any sense. If you have a bunch of sensors that are telling you, for example, that the temperature should be 75 Fahrenheit, and then every 5 seconds or every second it tells you 75, 75, 75.1, 74.9, 75, 75, you don't care about this. You're not gonna store this in the database to keep it forever. What you care about is if suddenly it starts dipping below 75, or if it starts heating up above 75. Then you can set things like thresholds, where those thresholds are gonna tell you like, well, okay, now I wanna get an alarm, and now I'm gonna start recording the data and keeping it. So this way later I can analyze what happened exactly, what other thing happened to maybe affect why the system started overheating. Maybe it's ambient temperature, maybe it's the outside temperature, maybe it's traffic. There's a lot of different things. So you'll record only what you need to keep. But you still want to monitor everything, and you still want to be able to process it in real time so that if there is an event, you can capture it and keep it for later. And machine learning is going to be very important for that as well. Because with machine learning, sometimes it's not as easy as simply setting like a low and a high threshold and simply saying, that's it, give me an alarm. It's also seeing trends so that you can identify ahead of time when something is going to go wrong. In this way, you can have a machine learning algorithm that's gonna process the data and say, you're not out of your threshold yet, but you will be soon. Maybe like in 4 hours, you will be. And of course, the threshold is sometimes a little more, a little harder to calculate, because if it's just a temperature sensor that is pretty linear, you don't need a rocket scientist or machine learning to basically calculate that and see trends. But for example, if you're a cow farmer and you basically attached pedometers and gyroscopes on an anklet on your cows so that you can detect a pattern of pacing to determine if a cow is going to go in heat, because when you do, then you can do artificial insemination on that cow, and then you will have a higher success rate by about 28% higher if you catch the cow at the right time. Well, now analyzing the pacing pattern of a cow is a little harder than a straight temperature line. So that's when you're gonna start using machine learning. And it sounds funny to talk about a cow like this, but trust me, that's a project that we have done with Fujitsu, which is aptly named the Connected Cow. And it's basically a bunch of cows connected to the cloud, and it helps farmers to basically, not farmers, but cattle cattle farms to basically do more artificial insemination so that they can replenish their herds. And artificial insemination, just like with humans and with cows, it also costs a lot of money. So if you can actually have a higher success rate, then it's good for the bottom line of those farmers. So with Azure, we have a whole suite of IoT services. I'm not going to go in depth because this is not an Azure session. Today we're going to focus more on the client side. But just to give you a quick idea, you would have something like the IoT hub, and then from there you would use something like Stream Analytics to analyze the data coming in. Stream Analytics, the way I explain it is, it's like doing queries on moving data. So think of a traditional query would be going to a parking lot and counting the number of red cars, versus streaming data is like going to a highway and counting the number of red cars. The cars are moving on the highway, so you'll have to find like a sliding window of between which point and which point and for how long do you want to count the cars. So you're basically calculating and querying moving data. And that's what Stream Analytics is. And then from there, you've got storage blobs where you can store a lot of information, event hubs. You can immediately display that on web apps if you want. You can use machine learning to analyze the data. And then ultimately, you can store whatever events you want to keep. You can use Power BI to create dashboards and data visualization for all that data. And then from there, you can have a bunch of logic apps that will connect to other systems like ERP systems and CRM systems and so on. So this is just the big picture of what a traditional like IoT setup can look like. But it all starts with this right here. This part right here is the devices. The devices out there, which can be computers, which can be phones, but which can also be any kind of gadget. And the goal today is to tell you quickly how can you start building those gadgets without starting completely from scratch. Which brings us to our friend, the Raspberry Pi. So who's actually played with a Raspberry Pi before? Okay, a bunch of you. Who's actually played with Windows 10 IoT Core? So a couple of three, four of you. Okay. So this session is pretty much targeted at people that have never touched this before. The Raspberry Pi is pretty exciting because it's a device that was originally created for educational purposes. And the idea was to bring more computers in schools to teach kids about computer science and programming, because sooner or later, people will have to realize that everybody will need coding skills in the future, not just professional developers. So the average cost is anywhere from $30 to $45, depending on the model, depending on where you buy it and the markup. There's been several models so far. There was the Raspberry Pi 1, which had the A, A+, B, and B+, and then Raspberry Pi 2 and Raspberry Pi 3, which are both called Model B. The generations are basically based on the ARM chip that's in there. So the first one was based on ARM V6. And then Raspberry Pi 2 is based on ARM V7, and Raspberry Pi 3 is based on the new 64-bit ARM V8. But still, just like $30, $40, you know, for this device. It's about the size of a credit card in terms of its surface area. It's a little thicker, of course, because of the ports. By default, the Raspberry Pi was meant to run Linux. That they even created their own flavor of Debian Linux called Raspbian, which comes with a bunch of little utilities like a browser, and it's got Scratch and Python programming and things like that to help kids learn computer science. But the thing is, when you ship a computer for less than $40 that has four USB ports, yeah, not kidding, four USB ports. My Surface Pro only has one. And this has four USB ports. And it has a full GPIO, so all these pins that you see here, this is for GPIO, which means that you can interface sensors and inputs on it. And it's got a built-in GPU with HDMI and sound and a storage card as well. Well, you can imagine how there's more than just people in education that went gaga over this device. The makers just like started building with this, and they realized, oh my God, this can power a robot. Because instead of like duct taping a laptop, you know, to a robot, now you can just have a little Raspberry Pi like this, and you can power any kind of electronics project. So makers basically fell in love with it. Yeah, you can, beyond Python, of course, you can even on Linux, you could program it with C Sharp using Mono. But now, of course, we have a new operating system that can run on this. So in the first few years, they sold 5 million units of the Raspberry Pi, which actually made them the largest computer manufacturer in the UK. It's kind of funny when you think about it. It's a new device, but we also have a new version of Windows that came out last year. And we decided to create a version of Windows called Windows 10 IoT Core that can target the Raspberry Pi. So you can technically run Windows 10 on a $35 computer. So the main site is going to be dev.windows.com/IoT to get started. And it runs on the Raspberry Pi 2 and 3, not the original generation. So it's got to be a 2 or a 3 to run Windows 10. Now, Windows 10, of course, why did we decide to branch there? Well, it's not something that started yesterday. For a while, we've been trying to converge all the different versions of Windows and devices, from Windows Desktop to Windows Phone to the Xbox even. And ultimately, Windows 10 is our final destination. We finally arrived. We have one core Windows that can run on everything, including new devices like IoT, HoloLens, and Surface Hub, and it's one core operating system, one app platform, and then one store. So as a developer, it's an awesome story because you don't have to build multiple versions. You can just build one app. And then, of course, the app can both run everywhere, but it can also light up and take advantage of the features that are unique in each platform. So that means that Windows 10 will be able to run all of this, from phones, tablets, phablets, two-in-ones, hybrid, ultrabooks, netbooks, desktops, laptops, and then eventually the new things like Surface Hub, Xbox, holographic, and IoT. But the idea is that it's not just to run on these devices, it's to make sure that it's tuned for those environments. So that means that on the PC, Windows is the same familiar operating system with a broad hardware ecosystem that where a lot of devices can be supported. You've got full compatibility with all of the 30 years of desktop apps that we've been supporting there. So nothing changes with that. On phones, though, it's a different story. On phones, it's not about backwards compatibility with desktop apps. It's about having the mobile shell that has made the platform fairly unique. And I know not many people use it, but the bottom line is most people that that love Windows Phone, even with all the critiques that can go against it, everybody pretty much agrees that the shell is a very unique experience that is much more interesting to use on a daily basis. You got telephony included, and of course you've got compatibility with all the back applications for Windows Phone since 2010. And then on Xbox, then of course you're not going to have the classic start menu. You've got a shell experience that is meant to be seen from 10 feet away. And you've got shared gaming, you've got app and game compatibility. You can actually, did you know that starting this summer, you can now build a universal Windows app and then publish it on Xbox? Did you guys know this? I mean, yeah, now you know. Because, the store is open, and then you can submit your apps, and you can build the same application that you can build for Windows, you can submit it to the Xbox, and there's a whole new realm of opportunities there. And then after that, there's all the other versions, again, with the same core base OS. And when we look at the Universal Windows Platform, or UWP, you basically have the same set of languages you can use, from C++ to C#, VB, you can still use JavaScript if you want. And then you have UI frameworks like HTML, XAML, DirectX. And then in terms of APIs, you'll use WinRT, or rather UWP, the new name for it. And on desktop, you can still use Win32. You can still use .NET as well. But of course, when it comes to Windows 10 IoT Core, it's going to be about UWP right here. That's what you're going to use. And it's the same application model for this. And these, in the world of IoT, will run on a new family of devices, including the Raspberry Pi, which I've already covered so far. There's also the Minoboard Max, which is a device that runs running an Intel Atom chip. So when you buy usually cheaper tablets or cheaper laptops that don't run the Core i architecture, they actually usually run the mobile chip, which is usually the Atom. So the Atom is very, very cheap, and this is basically like having a board that has the guts of a tablet. So if you say, we need the whole power of a tablet for this, but I don't want to, again, just interface with a tablet, I can just get a board. The Minoboard Max is great for this, and it does work with Windows 10 IoT Core. And then if you say, what I would love to use is a smartphone, because a smartphone will come with GPS and with Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, with a nice Snapdragon architecture. Well, there's also a board called the Dragon board, which is based on the Qualcomm architecture. And that board is also supported by Windows 10 IoT Core. And while today I'm going to focus on the free edition of Windows 10 IoT Core for makers and anybody that wants to go download it, there is a path forward beyond that, where there is a professional version of Windows 10 IoT Core that is made primarily for OEMs and original device manufacturers, where they can do things like differing updates, and it gives them different packaging options as well. And then you also have Windows 10 IoT Mobile, which is kind of like the industrial version of the Windows Phone, of Windows 10 Mobile, for handhelds that are going to be more ruggedized, maybe with built-in barcode scanners and things like that. And then you've got Windows 10 IoT Enterprise, which is the new Windows 10 version of Windows Embedded, the version that I was telling you that runs in things like ATMs, for example, or inside of a car or inside of a gas pump or things like that. And beyond that, we've got other projects like .NET Micro Framework, which is now open source that is still supported. We've got Project Lilium as well, which is kind of like micro-framework, but more lean, can actually be compiled, and Windows Embedded Compact, formerly known as Windows CE, which is still around. It's not running the Windows 10 core, but it's still actually, so far, the only version of Windows that can run in real time. So the Universal Windows Platform, and I'm going to jump in demos very soon, the Universal Windows Platform is basically one operating system where you have one Windows core for all devices. The same app platform runs across the whole family. You've got one dev center so that when you go submit your apps, you don't have to submit it multiple times for multiple families. You do everything in the one dev center. And then you have one store so that you can actually publish your applications for multiple devices, including the Xbox and the HoloLens now. If we look at the Windows Core basically gives you kind of like all the core APIs of Windows that are available across the entire family. But then beyond that, of course, we have a desktop SKU of Windows and a phone SKU and an IoT SKU and so on. So there's going to be a portion of APIs that only exist on the desktop SKU and other APIs that only exist on the phone SKU. But I'll be honest with you, I don't have the latest number as of Windows 10 anniversary, but as of the previous version of Windows 10, if you look at the entire sum total of all APIs in UWP across all SKUs, the proportion of APIs that are common across the board was 86%. 86% of all APIs you could call from any version, from the desktop to the phone to Xbox to HoloLens, and yes, to the Raspberry Pi. So for example, cool things like if you want to do text-to-speech or speech recognition, we've got great namespaces in Windows.media, speech synthesis, and speech recognition. Those are part of the core. So you can do text-to-speech and speech recognition the same way on the HoloLens as you would on a Raspberry Pi. And then finally, if we just look at the full picture of Windows 10, because I know a lot of people get confused by what is UWP, because a lot of people think that UWP is a new layer or a runtime like .NET, you know, that sits on top of Win32. But if we look at the world of Windows 10, for compatibility purposes, of course, Win32 is still there. So you can still build your applications with .NET, which has the .NET runtime. So there's two separate things. The .NET languages, like C#, VB, F#, and so on. And then there's the .NET runtime, which gives you the CLR and garbage collection and type safety and all of that. And then you would build with WPF, Windows Forms, MFC, directly on C++, for example, and those are all based on Win32. And this is where a lot of people get surprised sometimes when I show them this. The Universal Windows Platform is not a layer on top of Win32. It is the new base API of Windows that sits directly on top of the kernel. Because a lot of people think that this box goes on top of this box. Not the case. When you are building a Universal Windows Platform app, you are building a native application without a runtime. So even though you're using VB or C#, meaning the .NET languages here, you are not using the .NET runtime. You are not building a .NET app. There are .NET profiles that basically let you use .NET compatible code, but ultimately this is running with something called .NET Native, where the application is compiled natively, just like a C++ app, running directly against the core API of Windows. And then from there, you can use things like XAML and DirectX. You can use HTML and WinJS. And then we also have our bridge projects. The bridge projects is basically what allows you to use code from elsewhere. For example, use Win32 and .NET code in Centennial to run it as a store app. Or use a web application where that's Project Westminster that's been out for a year now, where you can take a web app and package it as a UWP app. Or Project Islandwood, which is our Objective-C bridge, where you can take Objective-C code, bring it to Visual Studio, and directly compile it for UWP. So I just want people to really understand what the ramifications are for UWP, because it's way bigger than you think. And this is the API of the future. So of course that means once you've pretty much standardized on Windows 10, you should try to move away from Win32 and focus more on UWP development, even for enterprise purposes. So Windows 10 IoT Core. Windows 10 IoT Core, first of all, you have to understand that this is not going to be your classic Windows where you're not going to see a shell on it, and you're not going to have the ability to quickly like swap between apps. In Anniversary Edition, we now have the ability to run more than one app, but again, you have to be careful given the amount of memory that you have here. And remember that these are IoT devices. They are not meant to be sitting there with a keyboard, a mouse, and a screen, and a user in front of them. So we did not build Windows 10 IoT Core for the educational mission of the Raspberry Pi to bring more kids into computer science. We built it strictly for makers. You deploy and debug directly from Visual Studio, and then you've got other options for managing it, like a website, PowerShell, SSH. So to show you the shell, actually I'm going to show you the live shell, because I've got it running right here on input 9. So this right here, I have a Raspberry Pi connected here. This one does happen to have like a screen connected to it because I wanted you to see the base shell. But when you install Windows 10 IoT Core, this is what you're going to see once you're done booting. The experience to actually install Windows 10 IoT Core is very easy. There's a nice dashboard that I can show you that basically explains how to flash an SD card, because the Raspberry Pi itself is not going to come with a micro SD card. You'll have to get like an 8 or 16 gig, we recommend 16 gig card, and then from there you basically flash Windows 10 IoT Core, which is completely free. So this shell is basically just like what we call the starter app. It will give you information like, for example, the devices that are currently connected to it. So in this case, it's interesting, because I unplugged my direct connection to my PC. So if you can have multiple network adapters. Right now I'm connected via Wi-Fi to my Verizon Jetpack, because of course these are devices that cannot connect to a gated Wi-Fi. So you know when you connect to a Wi-Fi network and you get a pop-up window that either in a hotel where you have to enter credentials, or even here at Microsoft on our guest network, you still have to go click the connect button. Even though there's nothing else to do, you click the connect button, and unless you click that button, you don't have access. That's what we call a gated access. There is no browser on this that will pop open so that you have to connect to something. It can be secure with a password, of course, but like an SSID and a password, but it cannot be gated. That's why I'm using my own Jetpack here for this. You will see the IP address, you'll see the name. By default, the name will be called Minwin PC, but you can change it to whatever you want. And then you'll see what network you're connected to, your IP, the operating system version, which is important because it's actually self-updating. So I've experienced this a few times over the last year. There would be a new build of Windows 10 IoT Core come out, and then I would just leave it powered on for the night. I come back the next morning, and the version number has updated here. So that's pretty cool, because something that's really painful is when you have, remember, you're not just going to have one of these. In a real IoT scenario, you might have dozens of them, maybe even hundreds of them. If you have to go and flash every one of them every time there's an update, it's really annoying. So with self-updating, it's a great operating system. And then it shows you here all the different devices that are connected to your USB ports. So in terms of how you actually install this, what you do is you go to, let me go back to the main page here, let me scroll up. You go to dev.windows.com or dev.microsoft.com/IoT, and then you will end up on this page right here. This is where it explains like what is IoT Core, how to get started. So you click Get Started Now, and then on Get Started Now, you basically are presented, I got the same page twice. You're presented with, first of all, what hardware do you have? So I can see, for example, I have a Raspberry Pi 3, and then either you're going to install it onto a blank micro SD card, or there's also Noobs, which is a kind of like a special flat SD card from the Raspberry Pi Foundation that lets you select the operating system that you want to install. And Noobs actually does feature Windows 10 IoT Core as a standard OS now on the same level as Raspbian and some of the other flavors of Linux. And then when you say that here, it will basically tell you what is your OS version. So you can go to this just a straight Windows 10 IoT Core, which at this point will be the new anniversary update. Or you can go to the Insider Preview, because we have an Insider program where you can get like earlier builds of Windows 10 IoT Core, just like you can get on desktop, tablets, and phones. And that basically lets you participate in the newer builds right here. And then once you do that, then to continue to set up process, what it's going to do is it will actually launch. It will tell you to get the dashboard. So I already downloaded. You just click download dashboard. So I already downloaded this. So if I just search for IoT, I have the Windows 10 IoT Core dashboard right here. I already had another version running, so I can close it. The Windows 10 IoT Core dashboard right here. If you are currently, if there are certain devices already connected to your network right now, you should actually see them in here. In this case, for some reason, it's not showing me my device until I actually connect to it, even though I am on the Verizon. And then to set up a new device, you come here, and then you say what device you have, like a Raspberry Pi 2 or 3. It's going to be the same image, a Miniboard Max, a Qualcomm Dragon board, or it could be custom. Custom would mean like if you got like a flash separately, like through the Windows Insider Preview, you will just get like an FFU file that you download, and then from here you would just go manually select the FFU file that you want to install. So you say Raspberry Pi 2, the build is going to be Windows 10 IoT Core. You pick your SD card. In this case, this is my internal SD card that I use for storage, so I'm not going to flash this. Here you could actually pre-name the computer, the device, ahead of time so that you don't have to use MinWin PC. What it will do is it will first boot, and then within 10-15 seconds, you'll kind of feel like it's kind of locked up. It will actually do a reboot, and by the time it's rebooted, you'll see the new name. You can immediately set your administrator password. By default, if I remember correctly, it's like P@SSW0RD as the password. It's in the docs. But what I recommend, of course, is set your own administrator password right now, because the last thing you want is somebody to go around and when they see your Raspberry Pi on the network is to start hacking into it because you just left the default password. Kind of like all these Linksys routers everywhere that we see in big cities that people never change the default password and you can just hack into them. You can even like set up like a network connection right now for it. And then you accept, you click download and install, and it will give you a prompt that says, okay, are you sure? Because it's going to erase everything on that SD card. So you can use like a card reader, for example. And then it will simply download Windows 10 IoT Core, and then it will flash your device. Make sure you don't walk away when you do this, because when it's time to actually flash the device, it will give you like an administrator prompt that you need to click yes on. So once that prompt is done, then the flashing begins, and then you can do it. And then if you want to flash more cards, then you can just, it will say, do you want to flash another one? Windows 10 IoT Core has already been downloaded on your machine, and now it will not like re-download it over and over. So that's a fairly easy process to install Windows 10 IoT Core. And if you want to see the process in action, it's changed a little bit, but not too much. We actually have a show on Channel 9 called The Maker Show. And my colleague Kenny Spade actually did a full walkthrough of the installation of Windows 10 IoT Core and a Raspberry Pi in episode 5 of The Maker Show back in like March or February or March. Now, when you start coding with this, you will be working with different interfaces. And if you want to understand the interfaces that are available in the world of electronics, it's kind of interesting to draw like the comparisons compared to how it is in the world of computers. So for example, you've got something like SPI, which is a serial peripheral interface bus, and it's a synchronous serial communication interface that is basically used for short distance communication. And it's primarily used in embedded systems. So you actually get a namespace for this called Windows.Devices.SPI. And in the PC world, SPI would compare kind of like to PCI Express in terms of a bus. Then you've got I2C, which means inter-integrated circuit, which is a bidirectional two-wire serial data and serial clock bus. And it's used for inter-integrated circuit control. And you access this via the Windows.Devices.I2C namespace in Windows. And it's akin more to the PCI standard on PCs. The one that you will be using, that the one that I'll be using today, though, is GPIO. Where GPIO is do-it-yourself communication, you get your pins, you talk to your pins, there's no special protocol for it, kind of like the old RS-232 that we use on PCs. But don't worry, we're not going to use old serial 9-pin ports on this. We're just going to talk directly to our pins via GPIO. So that map is actually quite good to keep handy. It's in the docs, don't worry, it's all available there. I highly recommend printing a copy of this and sticking it to your wall where you're doing electronics, because on a Raspberry Pi, you've got all these pins on the right that are like right here, all these pins. That's your GPIO and your SPI and your I2C and all your ground pins as well. And unlike an Arduino, you're not going to see the names of the pins directly on the board. So you either have to have like a really awesome memory to remember all this, or you can just quickly look it up to see the numbers. And remember that you see here, for example, how it says GPIO 5 is on pin 29. In your code, when you're going to start referencing pins using a number, you're not using the pin number, you're using the GPIO number. So for example, if I want to talk to GPIO 5, I will actually use 5 as my pin number, not 29. And if you need a ground, then you just connect directly to a ground pin and you've got several grounds that are available in there. All right, so let's jump into a demo to get started with this. So let me get a couple extra cables here. There we go. So what I have here, and I'm gonna replug this so I can show you what it looks like. And I have a little document camera. Where is my document camera? There it is. So you can actually see my little setup here. I'll go full screen. All right, so what I have here is basically, it's kind of slow right now, I don't know why. So what I have here is a Raspberry Pi. It's inside of an enclosure, so I could have like a more open enclosure like this here, so you can see what it looks like. I really don't know why my camera is so slow right now. Let me try again, maybe a different port on this. Just as slow, apparently. Okay. Anyway, the bottom line is we can see it very well. So all here is basically our GPIO pins, and then we basically have the ability, and I'm going to move this off right here. So I've plugged right now a Ethernet cable directly via a USB interface on my computer so that I can actually communicate via the internal IP. And then I've got the screen here that is connected via HDMI, which is what allowed you to see basically this right here, to see the actual device. And then this is my power right here. My power is just a micro USB cable. It's gonna keep sliding, okay. You can actually use, if you want, the USB port on your computer to power a Raspberry Pi, but I don't recommend it, because sooner or later, your Raspberry Pi project is going to start drawing more and more power. It can go up to 5 volts. And sooner or later, your USB ports is not going to be able to provide that much power. I've seen this before, especially with this, where I try to power the Pi and my little camera here, and maybe even like a mouse or a projector thing. So that becomes a problem. So what I do here is I've actually plugged the Raspberry Pi directly into an outlet. So this way it gets its source of power independently, and you're not going to blow your USB port. If you blow your USB port, it's not a big deal. It's just kind of like it's an internal software short circuit. It's kind of like a breaker. So you get a little notification in your tray that's like really, really hard to notice. And then you have to go click on it, right click and do reset, and then your port is usable again. So anyway, so now that's the main deal with this. So now what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna use a little breadboard project right here. So who's done electronics before? So less than half of you, okay. So on the breadboard, you notice that you've got all these little holes in it. You've got the long bus right here, which is known as, I'll try not to move. This is actually called the power bus. The power bus is where you're gonna plug in your power and your ground. So in this case, you notice that I have a cable that goes from I have a resistor right here that goes from the plus side. I'll use my Surface Pen for this, it's going to be easier. So I have a resistor right here that goes from the power bus to the long leg of my LED. So this is an LED that I have right here. An LED will always have like a long leg and a short leg. The power has to come in through the long leg and exit through the short leg. So you plug your ground through the short leg and the ground back to the power bus here. And now what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna load in Visual Studio. I have some code just to show you a standard like a Blinky project. The Blinky project is both available on my GitHub as also in the default samples for IoT. And to create this project, there's a few ways you can do this. You can either say File, New Project, and there's a template you can actually get directly from the IoT site. And then in here, you can actually come and select under Windows 10 IoT Core, you could create like a background application IoT, but traditionally you're just gonna come and create a standard blank app. So universal, Windows universal blank app. It doesn't have to be a specific IoT project. But to make it an IoT project, because remember how I said that any universal Windows platform app can run on all of the platforms, you could technically take any UWP app and then immediately deploy it to a Raspberry Pi and it will run. Of course, if it's a very heavy app with a lot of data and a lot of controls, you will feel the sluggishness of, you know, the device. Remember, this is only a $35 computer, so it's gonna be a little slower. And then, if you wanna start using some of the more advanced features of IoT, what you're gonna do is you're gonna come here, and under References, you're gonna say Add Reference. And this is where you have to use what we call an extension SDK. Remember how I told you that there's 86% of all APIs that are shared? What do you do if you want to use the other 14%? You have to use an extension SDK. So if you want to use the ones that are only for IoT Core, then you come to Universal Windows Extensions, and then it will show you the list of extensions right here. Notice how we have the desktop extensions for UWP, the IoT extensions for UWP. Let me extend that a little. And then the mobile extensions for UWP as well. So in this case, we selected IoT extensions for UWP version 10.586, which is the November update. I don't have an update yet for the anniversary update here. And then I click, yeah, that's one of the most hated dialogue in Visual Studio, by the way, because just clicking on this, for example, let's say you open it and you come here and you say, oh, I want this, and you click OK, doesn't work. You have to come here, click the checkbox next to it, and then click OK, and that will add the reference to your project. And you notice here I have the Windows IoT extensions for UWP. Beyond that, I have a standard XAML page. So I'm going to open my XAML page. And my code is kind of big. You should see it well. The screen is kind of big, though, so we'll leave it like that. So it's just a basic Blinky demo like this. And then if I go full screen, so you can actually see the, I'll focus less on the UI. You'll notice that what I have is standard XAML, and I have two text blocks for the title, Windows 10 IoT Core, Blinky Demo. I got a button right here. And then I've got an ellipse, which is gonna be used kind of like to fake the LED on it. And then, I also have a text block down here where I can write like a status if I want. And then I simply put an image at the bottom. So this is our Blinky. And the code that actually goes behind this, let me open it up right here. So the code that goes behind this, let's go full screen. So you'll notice that we are just using standard Windows UI XAML media controls. We are using GPIO, Windows.devices.gpio. So this is something that comes from the Windows 10 IoT Core extension. And then down here, what do? First of all, I have to talk about the pin that I want to connect to, which is LED pin 5. So LED pin 5, we'll actually go and find it on our Raspberry Pi to talk to it. And then I need to have a GPIO pin, which is gonna be the main pin I'm gonna use to talk to. And then I have a pin value that I'm gonna write to the pin. Then I'm gonna use two brushes, a gray and a red brush. This is just gonna be to light up the ellipses directly in the UI. And then I have to initialize my GPIO. In that GPIO, first thing I have to do is get the default GPIO controller from the device. So when I call this, of course, if I run this on my Surface,
I'm not going to get a GPIO controller because there's no GPIO controller on my Surface. So I check here to make sure that, is it null? If it's null, then there's no GPIO controller on this device. If I run this on a Raspberry Pi, it will give me the default GPIO controller. The next thing I need to do is to open the pin. And then when I open my pin, I have to say which pin number I want to open. Remember, this is the GPIO number, not the pin number. I make sure my pin is not null, and then I have to set the drive mode for it. Because GPIO means general purpose input and output, then I can use a pin both as an input to read data or as an output to write data to it. So lighting up an LED is considered to be an output. I am writing to the pin. Displaying something on a little LCD screen would be considered an output. But if I put like a temperature sensor or a light sensor or a button on my hack and I want to go read these values, these are inputs. So here I'm saying that the GPIO drive mode is output for my pin, and now I'm setting a pin value of low, which means low voltage, so the LED is going to be off. And now I simply write that value directly to my pin. I have a button click in this one here. The button click, instead of a blinky that's tied to a timer, this one is a blinky that's tied to an actual button that's on screen. So I go read, I've got an event handler from my button on screen, and then I simply check to see if the value is high, then I set it to low, and if the value is low, I set it to high. I go write the pin value, and I change the color of the LED accordingly. Now, hopefully my connectivity issues have been resolved, and I'll be able to deploy to this. To deploy, you are deploying to an ARM device. So that means here, at the top, you have to select ARM as the deployment architecture. You've got x86, x64, and ARM. When you're deploying to your Surface or your laptop, you're deploying to x86 or x64. Notice how any CPU is gone. There's no option for any CPU here. That's something you can find in .NET. Why? Because .NET, you're compiling to IL, intermediate code, and then the JIT compiler will then compile to the CPU architecture that you're running on, which might be 32-bit or 64-bit. But here, this is not .NET. Remember, this is UWP running .NET native. There's no JIT. You're directly compiling for the architecture, so you have to specify if you want to go x86, x64, or ARM. And this is not just for Raspberry Pi. This is true for all UWP projects. Any CPU is gone. So if you are in a multi-project, like for example, like Xamarin, where there might still be some any CPU configurations that are available, if you try to deploy UWP with any CPU, it will just fail. So that's a good trick to remember. So I'll pick ARM right here, and then I have to deploy to a remote machine because I'm not deploying this locally, I'm deploying this to another machine. So I have to specify where I'm going to be deploying this. So I'm going to say remote machine right here. The first time you select remote machine, it's going to give you a pop-up to select this. If you want to go back to that pop-up, you right-click your project properties, you go to the debug section, and then here you have the target device, which is remote machine. Here you can enter the IP address of your device, or you can do a find. So I'm going to click find. It did actually auto detect my Pi right here on this IP address, so I'm going to select that. Okay, universal unencrypted protocol, that's good. And then you just leave that as such. And then now I can do a remote deploy to my Raspberry Pi. Oh, crap, no, wait. I forgot to connect the LED over here. So let's cancel the build. Let's cancel that. Let's go back in here. I'm going to go full screen again. Because now, of course, I have to connect the Pi to my little hack right here. So first of all, let's remember where pin 5 is. So pin 5, we can see from the bottom left is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's pin number 6, and then 2 over, there's going to be a ground there. So I can come here, I start counting from this corner right here, and I use these little jumper cables. So I'm going to put my white cable at basically 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like this. And then 2 pins over is a ground. So I'm going to plug my black cable in here. And then I'm going to come and plug this into the power bus. I'm going to plug the ground is going to be here. and then the power is going to go to the main power bus. The key to remember is that on a breadboard, on the power bus, all of these holes are interconnected. So if you plug two cables along the power bus, it's as if these cables were connected together. Versus on the component bus right here, those little columns that you see, those are the only, the five pins are basically connected. One, two, three, four, five pins are connected. So this way, if I want to connect my resistor to my LED, I simply have to plug them on the same holes along the component bus. So now my hack is ready to go. So now I can actually come here and do my deployment. So let's try this again. We're going to deploy to a remote machine. And then it's going to hopefully deploy. I was having issues earlier. But the funny thing is, it is detecting the remote machine. It will actually turn on the remote debugger on the Raspberry Pi. So hopefully it does run. Otherwise, that's going to be a short-lived demo. Robot C, is it, so Robot C is it's a language you deploy on it? What is it exactly?
Yeah, I'm not sure if they were using these. I was going to have to ask him, but he's in a STEM class.
Oh, okay, it is deploying.
They do things with where they're having to open up gates and stuff and make the stuff go around. So it's early robotics, I guess.
Okay, I don't know. We'd have to see exactly what operating system is supported by that. So the question is, can you use this to deploy Robot C? I'm not familiar with Robot C. I know that there's things, for example, like Johnny 5, which is a set of kind of like proxy libraries you can deploy on an Arduino, and then you can talk to it remotely. So right now it's installing the missing frameworks for deployment, so it's good news that it's actually deploying. So Johnny 5 is something you would deploy to an Arduino or a Particle Photon, and then from Windows you would talk to it remotely, either via serial or via Bluetooth. I would have to look into Robot C to see what's required to run it. So now it's registering the application to run from layout. Now, of course, I would have to switch to input 9 to see what the screen looks like, and it should show up soon. It says a remote operation is taking longer than expected. Come on. It's interesting because it did deploy it. There you go. Okay, so our screen is showing up here. Now this is the part where to connect this. Do I have my mouse connected to this? Yes, I do have a mouse. So I'm going to have to move my mouse over the blink button right here. And what I'm going to do is go click on it. So when I click on it, it turns on the LED here. And for you to see it, then I'm going to switch back to my input right here. And then put the camera on this here so you can see it. And if I keep clicking, you can see the LED is blinking. So this, my friends, is Hello World Maker Edition. You blink an LED. Thank you. Okay, what if you want to do something a little more interesting? What I am going to do here is I need to plug this little hack directly into the Pi, but this Pi is not, this one doesn't have an SD card, so I'll have to use the same SD card as this one. So what I'm going to do is, first of all, when you're done with this, what you can do a proper shutdown, or you can just like yank the power cable out. And I'm going to remove all of this. There we go. We're done with this hack. I'm going to steal the SD card from this one here, and I'm going to plug it into this Raspberry Pi here, especially since I know that this one works well. Okay, plug the screen in. And I'm not going to plug the power just yet. So what I'm going to do for this is I'm going to use this little setup here. This one is interesting as well. You can actually buy this from, I think I got it from SparkFun. Instead of having a whole bunch of pins, cables that connect to your pins, you can actually have this nice flat cable that goes and plugs directly into your GPIO of Raspberry Pi, and then you can see here on your breadboard all of the different GPIO pins. So now you just go and connect directly to that here. So now what I do is I come and plug this here in my Raspberry Pi. Come on. Yeah, live electronics in front of an audience is always fun. And that's why I didn't power it just yet. There we go. So now I plug this in right here. And let's power the Pi. Let's put power back into this. Okay, let's see if I can, how can I do this? Because if I make it dangle, it's gonna fall off. It's not a great setup. Like this right here. Anyway, what we're gonna do is we're gonna go look at the code while the Pi is booting. Let's just make sure that it is booting properly. In the meantime, yep, so it's booting. Got your nice Windows logo when you boot. And then when it's done booting, you will see the same startup page here. Okay, so let's, what we're gonna do is come, so of course I lost the connection because I did reset it. Okay, now we're gonna switch gears to a different demo. This one, we're actually going to go read an input to actually control the LED. So this one is the push button sample. I'm going to open this one. So in terms of the structure of the project, it's pretty much like standard fare in terms of it's a UWP app, uses the same right here, the same Windows IoT extension. And then in terms of the code that goes in there for this one, this one, if I remember correctly, the XAML page should be empty. There's not really anything in this one because we are not using the UI. There's a grid in Ellipsis to see it. It shows the GPIO status, but this one is entirely controlled from the push button here. So if I go to the code behind this project right here, again, we initialize the GPIO, we get default, and then we have two pins that we're using on this one here. We have the button pin and the LED pin. So the button pin, it's declared a little lower here. The button pin is going to be 5, and the LED pin is going to be 6. Let me just make sure that this is the case on this project here. So yes, button pin is 5, LED pin is 6. Yeah. And then for this one here, what we do is we are, and actually I don't know if I have audio here, because I did add a little thing to it, which is to make it talk. But, all right, so back to here. In a GPIO, we get the default controller, we initialize, we both open the button pin and the LED pin. We set the drive mode on the LED pin to output, of course, because the LED is an out. And then we go write a high value to it. And then here, this is where we can set the drive mode. There's basically two that we can use here, which is input, pull up, or input. It depends on the type of button that you're using on this. And also what kind of input is supported by the GPIO. And it's basically to make sure that you don't have a lot of false positives. Like, you know, when you push a button, you want to make sure that you don't have, like, while you push, these are running at very, like, high clock speeds. So you don't want to have an event that's raised for every time that the button is pushed. You just want to click it once and get the event just once. Normally, on an Arduino project, you would have to do all of that work yourself to check the pin value. And once you see a click event, basically, it's not gonna be an event. Once you see a high value on the pin, then you would have to go set a flag to say, okay, I got my high value, I'll just process it once. The beauty here is that, so we can set here a debounce timeout, which is gonna be to prevent that behavior. And notice how, even though we're doing an electronics project, we are actually simply setting an event handler on our button. So the button pin becomes an actual button. And we simply create an event handler for it. And then on that value, when it changes, I check the falling edge of the pin. And then this is where I can simply check for the pin value. And if it's low, I set it to high. And if it's high, I set it to low. And then I simply go write that value to the LED. So now my button controls the LED directly. All right, and this is simply to update the UI right here with the ellipsis, but we're not really going to focus too much on the UI in this one. Now, for deployment of this one, we're going to right-click on properties, and let's do a find again, see what has been auto-detected. So it's not been found. It's not a good sign. Let's see, make sure, did it boot here? So our Raspberry Pi is booted. It's on 1.141. So hopefully it's still going to work. Let's try that, 1.141. And let's, so we're ready to go. We're powered here. So let's deploy. Any questions in the meantime while this is deploying? Is this useful for you guys, by the way? Is this interesting? Yes? Cool. Okay, question here.
I have a question about your slides. When I look at the slides, it just looks like gibberish. All the text is gibberish. Anybody else getting that?
On the slides that are downloaded?
I will
check with the organizers. I did update one slide in there, so I have to give them an update. So I will make sure that the slides are in a proper format. Don't worry. And if for some reason it still doesn't get updated or fixed for them or whatever, just ping me directly. And some of the decks I also put on my SlideShare account. I have a link to my SlideShare account at the end. You can find the slides there as well. Yes, sir. How much of WCF is available as an extension package? As far as I know, WCF is not a protocol you can use from UWP. That's a .NET construct. That's basically a .NET set of classes. So typically what you would have to do is to call, you use more like HTTP client to make REST calls to the server. And then from there, in terms of having your WCF services exposed as web APIs, the best person to ask that question is actually here at the conference. It's Miguel Castro. Miguel is a big expert on WCF and also making it work in the same world as web API. And because you have to remember that WCF is more of an enterprise technology, whereas these devices are meant to connect over the internet. So the world has kind of shifted gears to go more towards like web APIs that can be powered by things like Node.js or ASP.NET web API. And you simply expose a REST endpoint over JSON. And then that's how you would do it. But Miguel would be a good person to ask about how to connect to WCF from a standard HTTP JSON library. But WCF is not included in UWP. All right, so now my project is running. So if I come here, I should see it on screen. Yeah, so GPIO is initialized. That's good. So now I can come here, just look at my little setup on this. Let me bring it over like this. And now if I push the button, you see that the LED, and I don't know if you see it, but the LED is right here. Okay, you see it? If I press, it lights up. If I press, it goes off. If I press, it lights up. If I press, it goes off. So now I've got a simple hack where I created basically an event handler in my code to control an actual hardware button, and now I'm controlling something like an LED. But you can imagine how it could be something like the push button could be a keypad instead of just a push button where you're entering a code, and the code could be connected to maybe to a database or something, and instead of an LED, it could be a magnetic latch on a door. So the idea is that I'm showing you some very simple demos here, but it's very easy to just take it one step further to now have an actual hack where you could create your own magnetic door latch but it is controlled by a Raspberry Pi to open a door based on a keypad, something like that. So there's a lot of potential with these things, and let me just jump back to slides here. So there is one more demo that if I had the time, I would have shown you. Unfortunately, I don't have the time. But if you want to experiment with this and if you don't want to buy a whole bunch of equipment, I highly recommend getting something called a Fez Hat from GHI Electronics. The Fez Hat is basically a little hat. They call it a hat because it sits directly on top of your Raspberry Pi, and it will give you, it's an onboard set of sensors and buttons and everything. You will get an analog input, PWM chips, you get two DC motor drivers, you've got two server motor connections, there's a single red LED, there's two multicolor LEDs as well that you can use. There's a light sensor as well, an accelerometer, a temperature sensor, two user buttons, so there's a lot of things you can do from that. But fortunately, don't really have time to demo this one. Beyond that, Arduino can be used with the Raspberry Pi as well, where you can basically take Arduino sketches and run them directly on Raspberry Pi with Windows 10 IoT Core. In the new anniversary update, we now officially support the Raspberry Pi 3. I'm almost done, Brian. And then you have a Windows IoT remote client. I tried to connect this morning, it didn't work. It basically lets you see the screen of your Raspberry Pi directly from your computer so that you don't have to connect the screen to your Raspberry Pi if you don't have one handy. And there's other capabilities like multiple foreground applications, so you can kind of build like kind of a starter shell, if you will. So in terms of resources and where to go from here, we have a whole set of labs that we published at Build that you can still go play with. There's even one set of labs that you can play even if you don't have a device, so you can kind of still play with UWP. So you go to ak.ms/codelabs. Remember, all the slides are posted. I have a show on Channel 9 that I started in January called The Maker Show. Great show where we had a lot of episodes just teaching you about this whole world of makers on different hardware, not just Microsoft stuff, but all agnostic stuff. We even had an episode on how to make electricity with lemons, another one on how to do soldering, things like that. It's a fun show. If you want to buy this stuff, my top two places are SparkFun and Adafruit. And then there's other sites where you can go to buy these things. Radio Shack is good in a bind if you still have one in your area, but the markup is pretty insane there. We have some IoT starter kits as well that we partnered with Adafruit and SparkFun to basically get started. Make Magazine, I highly recommend because it's a great magazine that basically gives you a lot of ideas about the cool stuff that people are building. And then Hackster.io is a great place to see a bunch of projects that people have built. These are more maker resources that are available to you. I told you I wanted to give you a whole bunch of resources, so just go download the deck. We'll make sure it works well. And then we got communities also you can go to. There's books from O'Reilly and Pact as well. Fritzing is a great software for diagrams. Virtual Academy has a few courses as well on IoT, one on IoT, one on robotics, and then these are more resources from colleagues that I have in DX. That's a panel I was on. So bottom line is have fun. Please remember, hack safely. Don't do any crazy stuff out there. And so that's it for me. So I'm going to have to bail pretty fast out of here. I did answer a few questions, but I'll be available in the hall afterwards. I got to give time to Brian to set up. SlideShare is where I post all my slides for all sorts of things. So if you can't find the slides on a repository, if they don't work well, you can also get the version over there. But I will make sure the repository is updated. So I hope this was useful for you guys. Please remember to fill out an eval. Let us know if you like this kind of electronics maker stuff at VS Live. And if so, then I can come back and do more. And have a great day.